died, Father, is nothing left. Ever since I was a child, I had the feeling that something is missing in me. I want to know why I'm here. Can any of us know that?
Become yourself. Then God and the devil don't matter.
I want to learn. I want to understand. Become. Can you find the force to enable these two quite opposite lives to live together in yourself? At any moment, the wolf can devour the lamb.
And you must learn what it means to become responsible.
This is an exact life. And that is why you are here.
Out of the foreknown history to the unknown future, this is Release Radio for the seeker.
I must try to know.
Wherever you may be around the planet, we welcome you to another Red Ice radio program. We are trying to do a sincere investigation into ideas, claims, research, theories, and documented material without sensationalizing the claims. We're trying to keep a balanced view. We interview authors, filmmakers, and thinkers on all kinds of different topics. We don't shy away from calling a spade, but the point is, we don't want to exaggerate the claims just to provoke a certain response. We simply want to know, that's our agenda. We want to find out, and we want to share those findings with you so that you can make up your own mind. So if you want to find out more, and if you want to follow us on a regular basis, we recommend that you check out redicecreations.com, our website, and I'm Henrik Palmgren. Thank you for stopping by. Today we're talking with Paul Levy. He has developed a unique and creative vehicle to introduce people to the dreamlike nature of reality that he calls the dreaming up process. Paul is a pioneer in the field of spiritual emergence, as well as an innovator in the field of dreaming. He returns to discuss his latest book, Dispelling Wetiko. In the first hour, we'll recap on Wetiko, a contagious psycho-spiritual disease of the soul, a parasite of the mind that is currently being acted out en masse on the world stage via a collective psychosis of titanic proportions. This mind virus, which Native Americans have called Wetiko, covertly operates through the unconscious blind spot in the human psyche, rendering people oblivious to their own madness and compelling them to act against their own best interest. Paul discusses how to deal with the collective psychosis and explains the upside to the madness. He talks about what can dissolve Wetiko and change the dream, bringing about an alchemical experience. Welcome back to the program, Paul. It's great to talk to you again. How have you been since we last talked?
Oh, I've been great. I've been real busy getting my new book out. But that's been quite something, but I've just been doing great. Thank you.
Excellent. Well, great job, of course, on your latest book. It's even better than the last one, I think. It's more crystallized. It's even clearer. And I guess that automatically happens since you're learning more as you go as well. Your understanding of what Wetiko or malignant egophrenia really is, as you describe it. You're becoming better at explaining it and also to diagnose it. And, you know, for me, it's a really profound topic. It's an extremely important one. I mean, if we go with the assumption that Paul is right on this, then it's at a time when there are so many problems in the world, and almost everyone is looking towards someone else to blame these problems on. This is very easy to do, of course, because there are in the real world there are conspiracies, there are agendas and interest groups lobbying for their cause, etc. So how to determine what is what, that is the question. Where to put focus, where does one need to heal? You know, these are some of the things I want to try to outline with you today a little bit better, Paul, from your perspective. But if I just understand it correct, you're trying to frame this topic, give it a name, attributes, and kind of introduce it, if you will, to as many people as possible so that a greater awareness of this psychic disease can take place. Is that correct, Paul?
Yeah, totally. No, I've been really trying not only to name it, but to create some sort of a map for it, to articulate it from as many different angles as I can imagine, you know, because that's all in the service of healing it, because it operates through not being seen, through the unconscious. So to the extent that we aren't aware of Watiko, of this psychic virus, that's the extent it can act itself out through us. So to the extent that we're able to really see it, that takes away its power and empowers us.
It's a fascinating topic, and obviously we've talked about it in the past. Again, though, we shouldn't leave anybody out who doesn't have listened to all the previous interviews. Watiko, or malignant egophrenia, just describe to us in the best way you can, Paul, what it is and how to realize what it is.
Sure. Yeah. No, and it's so funny. Like I'm inwardly sort of cracking up because I get asked this question all the time, and it's an incredibly difficult question to answer, because the thing about Watiko, it doesn't lend itself easily to language or to words, and because it's an actual psychic disease. You could think of it as this mind virus, whose origin is the psyche. It operates through the psyche, through our unconscious, like the blind spots, and the tool of our investigation into Watiko is the psyche, is the very medium through which it manifests. So that makes it really, really difficult to really get a handle on. And one simple way of describing it, it's a psycho-spiritual disease of the soul that exists in the collective unconscious of all of us. And that's to say it exists in potential in all of our psyches, that at any moment in time, any of us can fall prey to it and then unwittingly become an instrument to act it out in our life. And to just amplify it just a small bit, to make it more clear, it's one way of describing it is that it's this form of this blindness, of psychic blindness, that actually believes that it's sighted and that it really sees clearly. And not only that, but in an arrogant way, it believes that it's more sighted and sees more clearly than anybody else. Okay. Now, the thing about Watiko, so on the one hand, it doesn't actually objectively exist. Like if we think, oh, it's some sort of like this virus and, you know, I should be scared of it. No, it's not like that. It doesn't ultimately have an intrinsic objective existence, and yet it can destroy our species. And that's pointing at the incredible power intrinsic to us that we have in ourselves that we're unconscious of. And so this virus of the mind, in a way, it operates through that unawareness of it. And it works through the projective tendencies of the mind. Like we're always projecting onto the inkblot of our waking life, like we're having some sort of a dream. And we connect the dots, and then being like a dream, the inkblot will instantaneously shapeshift and reflect back the very perspective or our interpretation of how we're seeing this waking dream. And that happens absolutely in zero time. It doesn't take, you know, a certain amount of time. It happens outside of time. And because of that, we get tricked by our projective tendencies of our mind, thinking that what we're seeing actually objectively exists in a separate way from ourselves. And then we react to our projections, thinking that it's actually something real and objective and separate from us. And that unconscious process is the doorway through which Watiko then insinuates itself into our perceptions in a way that it flavors our perceptions such that it will actually act itself out through us in a compulsive way. It's really the same energy like with people who have like an addictive process. It's the same energy that informs any addictive behavior, and at the same time then that it acts itself out through us, it hides itself from being seen. Okay? Mm-hmm. So it's you know, that's why with my book, I'm actually really stalking it and you know, tracking its footprints and really creating as good of a map as I possibly can to really bring it to light.
Very good. It's called Dispelling Watiko, obviously, and we'll get into the first part of that, how to dispel it, a little bit later, but we need to obviously define it and explain what it is first and everything. But basically, Paul, are we talking about the id, the ego? Is it the same thing, or is it something different here?
Yeah, it's similar to the ego. The thing, it's a little bit, you know, of a tricky term, because the ego isn't necessarily anything bad. It's, you know, this organic development where we develop a sense of self that's ultimately not who we are, that we need to develop a strong ego to have relationship with archetypal transpersonal energies, that if we haven't developed a sense of self, then we're just going to be overwhelmed and possessed by these archetypal energies. So that's, you know, the ego has a positive aspect. And, you know, but where it falls into like being sort of this negative aspect is then when we, you know, just concretize ourselves in our own mind and identify with the ego. And that's why in an earlier book I had written, I was calling Watiko malignant egophrenia, or me disease, because ultimately it's a misidentification of who we imagine we are. And that misidentification is fundamentally at the root of the evil that's playing out in the world. And so it's like that clinging onto this imagined sense of self, then that explicates itself, you know, not only in our personal life, but in the collective body politic in such a way that it actually informs this deeper evil that actually is playing out on the world stage.
Well, it's good to make the distinction that we're not specifically talking about the ego. It's a separate kind of thing. And the problem here is as well is that it's been part of us for such a long time, of our makeup, I guess, that this madness has become normalized, as you put it in the book. So what in that context, Paul, do we even know what quote-unquote normal is at this stage?
Yeah, no, that's a twilight concept, normal, because the thing about Watiko, one way of understanding Watiko, it's a collective psychosis. And we're our species is totally in the middle of this collective psychosis in such a way that we aren't even talking about it. A lot of us aren't even aware that we're in a collective psychosis. So the idea of what is being normal, and particularly the idea of, oh, I want to be like this normal person in an insane society. Well, is that a symptom of being sane, or is that an expression of our own insanity that we become adjusted to an insane society? So the idea of what is this, like this normal, quote unquote normal, that's a questionable concept in and of itself.
Oh, indeed. Now, what are the signs that you would point to that proves that we're in a collective psychosis?
Oh, well, it's so funny. It's such a funny question, because there was one point a number of years ago I was writing an article about that we were in the middle of a collective psychosis, and I ran into a friend, and he asked me what I was up to, and I said, oh, I'm writing an article about the collective psychosis that our species has fallen into. And he said to me, oh, what makes you think we're in the middle of a collective psychosis? And
right,
that, like...
Right.
Baffled me, and I answered by saying, well, what makes you think we're not? Give me one piece of evidence that shows that we're not in the collective psychosis. But, like, you know, if I were to really be serious, I would say, well, one example is take a look at how we're investing our energy just as a species. We're more and more creating, you know, and investing all of, you know, just our financial, our resources, just our energy into creating weapons of mass destruction to seemingly protect ourselves. And in the process, we're actually destroying the biosphere, which is, you know, the life support system of our planet. So the fact that we as a species are actually creating, like in a way, this suicide, this mass suicide ritual, you know, on the stage of the world, if that's not pointing to a collective psychosis, then I don't know what is.
Well, some people have argued that this, whatever this is then, actually is part of nature's attempt to start taking out an element within it, in this case, mankind, because it hasn't played ball, if you will. It has not lived by the rules. And now this is the effect. This is nature going in. This is another Spanish flu and stuff like that. That's what I'm getting to. What do you think about that idea, Paul?
Right. Well, that's one way of looking at it, you know, that our just, you know, kind of participating in our own destruction, that's an organic process and all that. And, you know, I can hold that viewpoint as one viewpoint among many. But from another point of view, you know, if you see this as a dream, like, in other words, the way to see Watiko is to understand that we're having this mass shared dream. And so we're all dreaming up what's playing out in the world. And in a sense, we're all dreaming up Watiko. It's a dreamed up phenomena. It's not separate from our own consciousness. And the point is that encoded in its manifestation of this deepest, darkest evil, it's actually revealing something to us. It's showing us something about ourselves, about how we're co-dreaming. And if we see that, then all of a sudden, what the same energy that was bound up in Watiko in that was expressing itself in a destructive way, we're able to access it in a creative way, in a way that we can actually create this world that we want to live in. So the point is that encoded in the evil of Watiko is actually its own medicine and its own antidote and actually some form of like this blessing that can help us to wake up. So I would say that might be a more fundamental dimension of that process, that, oh, it's just an organic process and it's this natural way of you know, taking care of things. Well, but there's also an opportunity in it that we don't want to miss.
So that's interesting. That means basically also that it depends on where you are in the process of realizing this disease. That's depending on what, you know, how we view it. Is something good? Is it something bad? Initially, when you begin looking at it, you might fear it. You might think, oh my, this is insane. We have to get this rid of this, blah, blah, blah. But as you said, the longer you go and understand what the effects are, you realize that a seed within it, planted within it, has a positive outcome. It has something which is actually beneficial then to us at this time for, I guess, a specific reason, right?
Right, right. And that's why, like in the book, I continually contemplate that when you really inquire into what is the nature of Watiko, you know, its sources in the psyche, but yet it's this non-local phenomena that actually will manifest synchronistically through the medium of the outside world. So what that means is that when you see the evil of Watiko playing outside of yourself, out in the world, that's actually some sort of reflection of a similar process inside of ourselves. And when you really go into that, you begin to discover, wow, the opposites. What I thought, you know, here I thought like that Watiko is evil, you begin to realize, well, wait a second, it's actually, on one hand it's evil, and on the other hand it's actually spurring the evolution of our species. It's actually helping us to wake up. Wow, all of a sudden maybe it has a good aspect, and then you begin to realize maybe the opposites are kind of becoming indistinguishable. And, you know, the term coincidentia oppositorum, the coincidence of opposites,
sure,
that's the place in ourselves, and that is, in a way, an expression of the self, the wholeness of ourself, where you begin to be able to hold and see the indistinguished, you know, the non-separation of the opposites. And that's when you begin to see that out in the world and in yourself, that's an expression that you're connecting with the self, with your true nature, and that's the immunization from Watiko, and yet at the same time, that's what Watiko is showing us, is introducing us to.
So ultimately, this is not a black and white issue where this is simply an evil thing that has to be killed. But at the same time, as I think you made the analogy in the book as well, as you wrestle with this monster, with this dragon, that is also part of the curing process. So you have to enter into this quote unquote battle, right? To actually take this thing head on. But at the same time, as you maybe then begin to defeat it, if you know we're even at that stage yet where we can even talk about that, but when you're doing that, you really realize the benefits that it actually had for your own growth process. So it's both at the same time, correct?
Yeah. And that's why, like in the book, I talk about that. To understand Watiko, you have to, in a way, step out of the two-valued logic of, you know, the typical, like the Cartesian Western mind, where things are either true or false. And there's a higher form of this logic I talk about it in the book, where you're able to hold the opposites as both, you know, being both and in a certain way. And the thing about Watiko, you know, one way of understanding it, it's like I was saying, it's like this virus of the mind. But unlike with a typical, like with viruses, they'll mutate with reference to as we try to, like if we give them antibiotics or try to heal them, they will mutate. Well, Watiko forces us to mutate, you know, and it forces us, it literally demands that we get in touch with the part of ourselves that's invulnerable to its effects. So the way to defeat Watiko, if we can speak in that sort of term, is to actually access the part of us that's invulnerable to evil. And that's the true nature. That if we're fighting, you see, the thing is, if we actually, we have to engage with it, you know, because clearly there's evil that's manifesting all throughout our world, and if we turn a blind eye, that's just feeding the evil.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, so we have to engage with it, we have to come to terms with it, but if we get too overly identified with fighting against it, then we've already lost, because the thing about Watiko, it feeds off of, like, in a way, any sort of polarization, and that just feeds the bug. So we actually have to, engage with it, but not, you know, really get involved in fighting against it, because then that's already to have lost the battle. And like I'm saying, it's actually forcing us to get in touch with the part of us that's invulnerable to its, sort of effect.
Huh. That's very, very interesting. I want to ask you more about that later on. I want to ask you about this from a conspiracy point of view. You know, is our paranoia real, etc.? It's a very interesting aspect of this step. But before we do that, let's back up a little bit again. And I want to ask you, when you know or when you have an idea about when this first entered into mankind, if you will. I mean, is it something? I think you describe it as something contagious in the book as well, pretty much.
Yeah. No, it's definitely contagious. It's like a contagious bug that operates through the unconscious. And so when somebody is taken over by Watiko, you know, and they can become a carrier and they can really be embodying the Watiko germ to whatever degree they are, and when somebody is doing that, they, in a sense, have identified with the archetypal dimension, you know, so it's not just a personal energy, it's more a transpersonal energy. And when you do that, you have a certain, like, a charisma or a certain charm or a certain magnetism that then will easily entrance the unaware into that same archetypal orbit. So in a sense, then people with the same unconscious blind spot or part of them that's mad, because we all, to the extent that we're not fully awake, have a part of us that's mad, you know, then they get into alignment with each other. They get drawn together. And that, you know, feeds the sort of the collective, you know, psychosis aspect of it, when people, in a way, are like reinforcing each other's unconscious madness. And then this, in a way, an impenetrable, like a bubble, gets conjured up around people who have, like, you know, subscribed to that particular viewpoint, you know, if they're under the spell of Watiko, where any sort of reflection or facts or evidence of their unconsciousness, when that gets offered to them, they not only will not be open to it, and we've all seen this in the political, you know, stage, but they'll interpret that reflection as being like a threat or being demonic, or the person who's the messenger is like a demon, and they will try to destroy the messenger. So I think it's important to understand the way that Watiko, it operates individually through a person, but it also operates collectively through a whole group of people or a nation or a species, you know, and that's the way that evil can really, you know, act itself out, you know, on the global stage, is when it brings people together all through their unconscious parts and, you know, forming, and then a psychic epidemic happens, which is exactly what we're seeing today.
Now, your first book about George W. Bush is obviously about this, you know, him as being personification of this disease, basically. And I don't know how much you keep up on current events and politics, poll and media and everything else, but it's always fun to hear if you have any more, I guess, examples of who in your view actually has caught the bug and is like openly out there and, you know, think they're the greatest thing to mankind.
Right. Well, that's an interesting question, because part of it, like the thing with Bush, he was that was what inspired me to write the book, because he was such a living symbol of the disease in like human form. It was like he was the incarnation of this formless, higher dimensional, you know, bug in the human form. So he was actually revealing to us what it looks like. And so with now, I mean, people have been wanting me to write a book about the madness of Obama and all that. And the thing with Obama, you know, he seems so much like, you know, more intelligent and open-hearted and articulate and all those things.
Yeah.
And yet when you really contemplate what he's doing and the agendas that he's implementing, I mean, they're even worse than Bush in a lot of ways.
Absolutely.
And, you know, but the thing is, his cover is that, oh, he's such a, you know, so much more enlightened and compassionate. So,
but, and isn't that, sorry, Paul, to interrupt, but isn't that also then the traits of this, that we're talking about something, someone really, really charismatic that can kind of pose as being, you know, almost a savior,
exactly.
You know, kind of thing. Yeah.
Exactly. No, that's exactly what I was going to say, that one could see Obama as maybe even a sort of this disguise of the Watiko bug in a much more like palatable form. And but here's the problem with this. When we're saying, oh, Obama has it or Bush has it or whoever, you know, if we get into thinking, oh, he has it and we don't,
right,
then at that moment we've fallen under the thrall of Watiko, because it feeds on the diabolical, like, you know, that part of us that polarizes and projects out the evil outside of ourselves. So, you see, that's why we have to be careful when we investigate and even talk about Watiko to not actually fall under its spell as we're, like, investigating or talking about it.
All right, so let's get into this then and talk a little bit about our, you know, conspiracies, agendas out there, if our paranoia, if you will, then is real. Should we be afraid, if you will, of other people who are under the spell of Watiko and now collectively or in a group or under an agenda, politics, you know, whatever have you, are working against something that we, you know, think is very beneficial or something like that? I mean, you said it feeds on polarization, but where do you draw the line, Paul, of where we actually need to, you know, be active, if you will, out there in the real world and fight, if you will, against something that we believe in? Where do you stand on all this? Where should one get involved, and where should one not get involved, do you think?
Sure. Well, the thing is this. One, that you know, I mean, it's so amazing. Like, all the questions you're asking me, they're just sparking so much because they have all these levels that I can answer. So on the one hand, you know, there are people and these groups of people that totally don't have our best agenda, you know, at heart and are playing out these sinister agendas to centralize power and control. And, you know, so the thing about Watiko is that, you see, if we think, oh, well, I'm just going to, for example, meditate and pray and get myself in balance and then the whole, you know, everything will reflect that back out in the world, that's in a sense to fall under the spell of Watiko, because that's sort of this narcissistic point of view. Because if this is a dream, well, then our inner process is manifesting as the outer world, and that the way to work on our inner process is to actually fully engage and participate in the outer world. But we have to kind of combine our political activism with a higher spiritual awareness, because a lot of, you know, very well-intentioned political activists, they fall into just reacting out of hatred or anger towards the Watikos, and, you know, by having that stance, they're unwittingly, by their fighting, you know, and polarizing, they're unwittingly feeding, you know, the bug, because that's the signature of the disease, is the polarization. So the two, having, you know, the spiritual form of sort of a higher awareness of the deeper dreaming that's happening and being really politically active in the world, are really essential in a way to cross-pollinate, you know, one another. And now the thing is this, is that, you know, there are people who are really, you know, who are playing out and are instruments for Watiko. So they're fully taken over, and a lot of them get attracted to positions of power. And so they can actually, you know, kind of be in a position to implement their nefarious agenda. And it's important to understand, if you just take these people out of power, that's not going to do much, because that's not dealing with the deeper, almost you could say, the archetypal dimension that's giving shape to and informing this deeper process of Watiko. So then what will happen is that as time passes, just new people, central casting will send these new people to pick up those same vacuous, vacant, and sinister roles. So it's important to understand, oh, wow, there's a deeper process that's informing what's actually playing out in our third dimension. And when you begin to see that, that's when you begin to see, oh, wow, we're having a mass shared dream. There's a non-local field that synchronistically is expressing itself through events in our world. And as you begin to see that, you also begin to realize, wow, I'm part of that non-local field. I'm actually interconnected with everyone else. We're interdependent. That's the step out of the separate self And that's the point of view where you actually can be of benefit and have some sort of like, you know, you're actually protected from, you know, Watiko in a way, when you really step out of that, the whole imagination of being separate.
You know, it's a righteous and almost a religious blind spot. We had another guest with us a while back called Barbara Oakley. We've talked about this, and I think unfortunately many of our listeners didn't really understand that. We were trying to get to a point that is the reasoning basically is like this: I am right because I know I am, and because the forces that I'm fighting are so evil that I have a moral right to do anything in my power to eradicate the evil I'm fighting, which includes using the same method and tactics as those evil ones that I'm trying to, you know, eradicate and fight. So
you end up
becoming the enemy in a way, right?
Right. And that's, you know, in the book, I have a whole section on like sort of when you look at the thing with Watiko, its origin is the psyche. So when you study the psychological aspect of Watiko, you see, oh, the really fundamental psychological process that's going on is projecting the shadow. That to the extent that we're actually split off from our own evil, then what happens? We disassociate from it, and it gets projected outside of ourselves. And then one way of understanding it is always going back to this being a dream. In a dream, if I'm disassociated from a part of myself, it gets split off out into the whole, you know, the environment of the dream, which is, you know, what is a dream? But it's a reflection of our own mind. And then into the dream will come in somebody who's embodying the split off part of ourselves, that evil that we've disassociated from, and they'll be, you know, they'll be the incarnation of that evil. And if we're not aware of what's actually happening, we then will think, oh, the evil is outside of myself. And then they try to destroy the person who's embodying that, which itself is a reflection of the very inner process of wanting to get rid of their own darkness. And by doing that, by trying to destroy the evil as it appears out there, they become possessed by the very evil they're fighting against. And that's a psychological way of describing the process of how the Watiko germ actually will flourish in a psyche.
Very good. Now, so what do you think that the response should be? And this is a very difficult question, I know this, but again, if to preface this a little bit, it can be argued that the forces that decided them, for example, to take America into another war with Afghanistan and Iraq, and maybe now even Iran, if things go far enough, that they're under the spell of Watiko. And then we have another political class that are fighting against this. They're now in the process of doing other things, which means to take away the gun rights, you know, of Americans, the Second Amendment, mm-hmm. and all that. That's really on the wallpaper right now. And it's done in the belief that again, they're doing the right thing. But I see the same kind of blind spot there, the same kind of, well, arrogance, if you will, that they think that they are right, and whatever they do, they can't do anything wrong, and they don't follow through on the thinking the whole way. But in any regard, what should the response be? Is there any response where one can actively then, quote unquote, fight against this or speak up and say no against this without falling into the trap of being possessed by the same force and the same spirit, Paul? It's a very difficult question.
Right.
About that.
Right. No, that's a really difficult question. And it makes me think of, you know, that the way to really deal with the psychic epidemic that we're calling, whether it's malignant egophrenia, Watiko, whatever the name is that, you know, it's a non-local phenomena. So if so say there's whatever the evil is that's getting enacted in our world, whether it's, oh, our government wants to go to war, or people want to, you know, take away guns or have guns or whatever the point of view is. And then if we're getting, so, you know, that's going to be triggering something in us, because it's impossible, and this is important to understand, it's impossible when we see evil out there in the world to not have some sort of similar energy in ourselves get activated. It's similar to when you see the unconscious, when somebody is embodying and acting out their unconscious, it triggers your own unconscious. That's one way of describing the non-locality of the unconscious. The same thing with evil. When we see it out there, it triggers the evil in ourselves. So the point is, you know, instead of at that moment when we're triggered, instead of just focusing on the seeming problem is outside of ourselves and trying to heal that, and meanwhile, we're just totally activated and triggered and our unconscious is fully activated, it's an actual opportunity to self-reflect and to take a look at what's that inside of us that's the source of our trigger. What's gotten touched in me that's like reacting when I'm seeing the evil out there. So it's an opportunity to actually add consciousness to ourselves. To the extent we do that and we're able to assimilate that content, mm-hmm. that darkness in ourselves, then we actually become a more like whole person who's actually able to, in an embodied way, to be more of a genuine agent of positive, of help and change in the world, because it's through the change of an individual that, and it's, and then as more and more people begin to wake up and connect with who we are and actually connect with each other, that's the way of really dealing, at least from my point of view, of this evil that's spreading in multiple channels, in multiple, all these channels throughout the greater body politic.
Yeah, indeed. Do you think, Paul, that there's any way that we ever can let anyone be the, just the way they are without trying to change them, propagandize them, to have them to become something that we want them to be? I mean, this is a fundamental problem with mankind at this stage. Everyone want to fix, if you will, everyone else, instead of, as you said, kind of focusing on their own issue, their own problem. They are externalizing the problem and just saying, if only that person and this one and that group over that could change, everything would be great.
Yeah, no, that's, I mean, you know, I think of my teachers. I have these incredible, these spiritual teachers, and they embody the whole perspective of they're just not wanting to change anybody. They're not wanting to proselytize or convince anybody of anything or change anybody's viewpoint. They're just so embodying, you know, just in their being, the whole, not just the idea, but the experience of being whole and being, you know, really all embracing of who they are, that's the energy, how they actually interact with other people. And by carrying that frequency, it actually creates space for people to, you know, to connect with themselves, almost like it's a bridge that then people can, you know, because when you even subconsciously, you have the recognition of the energy, the vibration that these, you know, really awake people are carrying, that actually, that's contagious too. And that actually helps us to connect with that same energy in ourselves, you know?
Mm-hmm. And, well, in the book, you follow it through, you know, so-called civilization as well, that it's part of that. And it's somewhere in the cradle of mankind's civilization that this comes into the picture. And I think someone asked a while back as well, if this is something that can affect animals or even plants or anything in nature, or are they exempt from this, Paul?
Yeah, well, it's interesting because, you know, the nomical field is that there's no boundary, you know, with anything, that everything is seamlessly interconnected. So, you know, when it's a psychic energy, and if this is all a dream, then all of the manifestations, all the forms of the dream are an expression of the deeper psyche that's dreaming, which is us. So that would suggest that, you know, that all sentient beings of whatever nature, you know, are actually kind of feeling and affected. And I think, you know, a lot of us, you know, can relate to that when we, even with our plants can, you know, if we have a particular negative mood or whatever, who's to say that doesn't affect, you know, plants and definitely animals and all that. And, you know, but if I can just go back to something that you had asked me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, sure.
That you were talking about the origin of Wetiko, like when did I think it started in humanity? And then I got off on some sort of riff. But I was bookmarking that. That's a really important and an interesting question.
Good. Yeah.
Because, you know, there are all these mythologies. Oh, even in the Garden of Eden, you know, when the snake, that was like a perfect, in a way, metaphor of, you know, all of a sudden, you know, eating the fruit. And then, you know, it just that, from one point of view, can be seen as symbolic of the initiation of the Wetiko virus, at least in the Western imagination. But then there are all these other mythologies around, oh, these negative ETs, or, you know, some sort of trauma that happened a number of years ago, or our DNA mm-hmm. got corrupted. But the point, I think even the more important point, and, you know, I'm open to all of those investigations, but the important point is that being, when you really contemplate the nature of Wetiko, that it doesn't actually objectively exist, that it's actually getting recreated in this very moment or not, okay? Mm-hmm. So we ourselves are co-dreaming Wetiko into materialization each and every moment, which means that the origin of it is the present moment. Okay. And that I think is really, really important, because it's the present moment. By entering the present moment and really, you know, just being with it, that's the, in a way, the portal through which we can actually intervene in the dream, in the waking dream, and change the dream we're having, you know? So I think that's a really, an important point. And then one other thing too, I wanted to make sure to mention, the thing about Watiko, it's so trippy in the sense that if we think, oh, okay, Paul is talking, saying it doesn't exist. Well, you know, it doesn't objectively exist in the ultimate sense. Well, okay, then if somebody thinks, well, okay, it doesn't really exist, I'm not going to pay attention to it. Well, by them holding that stance, they're feeding Watiko. Because if you're in avoidance of Watiko, of evil, if you don't really engage with it, if you sort of like look away from Watiko, you're unwittingly feeding it. But on the contrary, if you think it's really real, oh, and we have to do something, you've also fallen under the spell. So that conundrum is actually showing us something about the nature of Watiko as well as the nature of ourselves.
I think at this stage, then, Paul, to be honest, as some people feel when they're listening to this, that they're kind of painted into a corner. Like they say, wait a minute, whatever I do, it's Watiko is there. Whatever I don't do, Watiko is there. Whatever I focus on, it's there. Whatever I don't it's like, wait a minute, where do I go here? What do I need? Is there anything that needs to be done? I guess we could ask Paul, what do people need to do, in your opinion?
Sure. And you know, what comes to my mind, it was what I was saying before about, to the extent, you see, the thing about Watiko is that it only will operate through our blind spots, through our unconsciousness of it. Okay, it can't stand to be seen. I mean, even now, I can easily imagine that the Watiko bug is really upset that I'm like talking about it and we're recording this and people are going to hear it, because right. it doesn't want to be seen. Because when you see its operations, like with evil, just like with evil, when, you know, if you actually shed light on evil, then evil has no power over you. You know, it's, and that's why I talk about in the book, I talk about the importance of finding the name. Because when you find the name, just like in mythology, when you find the name of a demon, it takes away its power, okay? Mm-hmm. And so that's why the one thing we can do is to really become more familiar with its operations, both out in the world, but particularly within our own minds. Because to the extent that we're unaware of its operations and how it flavors our perceptions and how it inspires our projections, and how it impedes our self-reflective awareness, that's the extent that it can just play itself out, and then we become an unwitting conduit for the bug to actually play itself out, whether it be in our individual life with our partner or with our children, or, you know, with groups of people, you know, through, you know, the actual body politic and what's playing out as events in our world. That's one way to answer it. The other answer, too, like I was saying before, to the extent that we can connect with the part of us that's invulnerable to its effects, and that's the true nature, that's the self. And in the book, I have a whole chapter on, you know, really pointing out and describing the nature of the self, of our true nature. And when we really become not only familiar with that, but just so connected with our true nature, in that we just abide more and more in that, then we're invulnerable. Then we developed an inoculation to Watiko, and it also cultivates a real humbleness, because we realize, oh my God, any of us at any moment can fall prey to Watiko. You know, think about who among us has not, you know, fallen into their unconscious and unwittingly acted out their unconscious in a way that's hurtful either to ourselves or to others.
Sure.
So all of this is really, and even a deeper answer is anything that cultivates genuine compassion, because compassion is the Watiko dissolver par excellence. But, you know, we need to make a distinction between what some traditions call idiot compassion, which is all just smiley face and patting each other on the back and, you know, and all that, compared to genuine compassion, which can sometimes appear really fierce and can really set a boundary. And compassion ultimately springs from when you recognize that other beings aren't separate from you, that we're interconnected and interdependent. That out of that realization, the energetic expression of that is compassion. And when you have compassion, which is an expression of the wholeness of our psyche and of ourselves, then Watiko can't at all take root and insinuate itself into our psyche. And then we genuinely become an agent, this bodhisattvic agent in the world.
So you're talking about tough love in a way as well, doing perhaps what is needed as you see it at a given time, but it might not be what's wanted or received with the other person that you're doing this to. I mean, and again, that's a very fine line to cross. What is seen as being, not evil, perhaps, is maybe too strong of a word, but not nice towards somebody. And how does that play out? Is this going to be traumatic for somebody? It's kind of like disciplining a child, I guess. I mean, it's as a necessity, but at the same time, in certain instances, it could actually traumatize the child. It's an incredibly fine line, right?
Right. No, totally. No, it's a really fine line. And that's where, as you were saying that, I was thinking that's where, I do Tibetan Buddhist practice, and they talk about the three gems, the Buddha, the Dharma, the Sangha, that you take refuge in, the teacher, the teaching, and the community. And it's the community, the Sangha, that's really interesting for me, because it's one thing, a perfect example of this. Say you're in a night dream and you have lucidity, you've woken up in the dream, right? Mm. Okay, that's one thing. But then imagine, and I'm invoking the imagination, then imagine that in that dream that you've now recognized its nature, that you're dreaming, that it's all your own mind, it's all your own energy, and imagine that some of the other dream characters in that dream, who are none other, if it's a dream, you recognize, oh my God, they're aspects of myself. Well, then imagine if they've actually also had lucidity and woken up, and then imagine you hang out together in that dream and you connect with each other and you put your realization together, trying to investigate what have we realized. And what you discover is that, oh my God, this dream we're inhabiting is nothing other than the externalization of our dreaming, of our own consciousness. It's our own energy. We're actually co-dreaming this together. When enough people come together like that, what they discover is that, oh my God, we can change the dream. And that's evolutionary. And I've been describing an actual dream at night, but that's what's available to us in our waking dream. Okay, and that brings in the idea of the Sangha, because when you connect and get in sync and in phase with other people who are also awakening to the dreamlike nature, to the wiles of Watiko, it doesn't make a mm-hmm. difference how you describe it, and you actually connect. It's what I call, you can conspire to co-inspire. So it's a real conspiracy theory where you can activate the collective genius in a way where the sum is greater, than the whole is greater than the sum of its parts, type of thing. And that's really what I see is the deeper process that's happening. It's like this universe is waking itself up, and it's waking itself up through us. And if we're thinking, oh, there's some sort of external off-planet deity or messiah who's going to come down and save us, that's to have fallen under Watiko. Because the point is, we are that messiah. And when more and more of us have that realization, because when you think about psychologically the word messiah, it actually means the coming into realization of the self. That's what etymologically the word has to do with. Mm-hmm. And so as more and more of us have that realization, we can put our realizations together and change the dream. And not just the night dream, but the waking dream.
Fascinating. And so the universe, nature, cosmos, God, whatever you want to call it, is handling this waking up process of us with a pretty fierce agent. But is it seeded by, I don't know what your view of God is, Paul, but do you think that it's seeded by the concept of what we could call God?
Yeah, no, I mean, I actually talk about that. I have a whole chapter in the book about the apocalypse, and that it's actually, something hidden is being shown to us.
Right.
And it's the self incarnating, not just through one man like it did 2,000 some odd years ago through Christ, but it's incarnating through all of humanity. But here's the difference, where with Christ, all of the darkness was kept out of Christ, and then, if you look at it symbolically, like the Christ event was a dream, then here over here is Christ, here's Satan. And there's the evil and there's the light, who, Christ was the embodiment of the light, but all the darkness was kept out from his incarnation. And then it was separated in the figure of Satan. Well, with us, you know, we are all tainted with our shadow, not just personal shadow, but archetypal shadow. And so here's the deity who's incarnating not just through one person, but through our species. And but because we actually all have a shadow, it's, you know, as God is getting closer to incarnating, I mean, it's exactly, this is what alchemy is about, that the you could say the ego and the self actually in a reciprocal way redeem each other, that, you know, think about, like, you know, that our species and God, that God is incarnating through the limited vessel of a human ego, while at the same time the human ego is actually becoming, like, in a way, sort of blessed and one with spirit. So the two, you know, the God and humanity, are one's ascending, one's descending, and they're meeting in the middle. But the point is, because we're tainted with darkness, having a shadow, then we have to come to terms with that darkness. And that's, like, from the mythological point of view, that's a way of understanding what's actually happening with the Watiko epidemic. Okay?
Speaking of, you mentioned alchemy as well. You say in the book, Watiko has to be hermetically sealed in an alchemical container in order to study it objectively. Tell us more about that and the importance of alchemy.
Sure, yeah, yeah. Well, and the thing with alchemy, you know, it's really, one could really sort of understand it as being like a symbol system of the transformation of the self and of the individuation process. And the point is that, you know, this, you know, in alchemy they talk about transforming the lead into the gold. But think about, what is the lead? I mean, first off, it has to do with the negative father, with Saturn, but it's also, in alchemy, it's called the prima materia. It's the chaos, the raw stuff out of which you make, and the gold is the enlightened mind. And, you know, so in a sense, it's like we all have our own prima materia. That's our wound or our trauma or abuse or whatever it is. And instead of thinking of that as some sort of error, no, that's the way through to make the gold. But when you go back to, because I talk about alchemy a lot in the book, because it has a lot to do with Watiko. In alchemy, typically the prima materia is in the hermetic vessel, and which needs to be hermetically sealed. So, and that has to do with symbolically that nothing gets projected outside of the vessel. That's the having to do with the self-reflective consciousness. But then underneath the vessel is a fire, the fire of some form of awareness, that if there's not fire, then the prima materia will not transform. But that means that there's going to be some form of pressure, okay?
Right, exactly.
There's going to be like some sort of creative tension in that vessel. And the point of the vessel, you know, and think of the vessel as ourselves, as our own psyche, that we need to be able to contain, because a vessel is a container. We need to be able to contain that creative tension and not split off and identify with one of the opposites and just project out the other, which is to actually develop a symptom or a dis-ease in our soul. But if we hold that, what Jung calls the tension of the opposites, together, then out of that experience comes a symbol, which is, he calls it a reconciling symbol, or the transcendent function, which you can think of as grace. And the transcendent function, its function is transcendence. It actually pops us out of our limited identity into, you know, a more expanded identity of the greater self, in which we're all interconnected with other beings. So the thing, and I can just go on and on about alchemy, and I do in the book, you know, it's a profound way of understanding Watiko.
It's real excellent stuff. I want to continue to talk more about that, Paul, in the second hour as we continue tie in the alchemical you know, work basically into this and what that is, because that's a symbol. That's something that's been kind of also alongside Western civilization at the same time, then, as you also see a, you know, this thread of Watiko within it. So also, again, we have this polarized situation with the potential problem and the potential fix kind of running alongside each other. Very, very interesting stuff. Before we take a break, though, Paul, let's give out your website, give out your details as to where people can pick up a copy of the book, give us the full title, and if there's anything else you want to mention about it.
Sure, sure. Okay, well, it just came out a couple days ago, the 15th of this month, and so it's out now, finally. I've been waiting for a year. And you can get it on either my website, where I'll send you autographed copies, and I'll pay for shipping. And the website, awakeninthedream.com, A-W-A-K-E-N, and then inthedream.com. Or you can just go to Amazon. It's available. They have ebooks on Amazon, or, you know, my publisher continually wants me to say, oh, wherever books are sold, you can also get it there. And so that's, I think, where it's available. And I'm just excited. I want people to read it because I feel like something came through me as I was writing it. I would write a chapter, and then the next day when I would read it, I would be like, wow, who wrote this? This is like really good.
Right.
It was like that type of experience.
Well, that's really good. You're in the zone, as you say, in touch with the muse. And I definitely believe that there's a lot of things right now in the greater knowing that wants to come out. It wants to be known. It wants to be, well, quote unquote, published then, if you will, because it wants to bring attention to these things because it's necessary for a greater awareness. And again, as I said before, I think humanity overall is in dire need of something like this right now for a bigger understanding. And this one is a really important subject, and I really recommend the book as well. So go check it out at awakenindthedream.com. The title is Dispelling Wetiko. Really, really good stuff. We'll continue, of course, with more after a short break. So stay with us, Paul. Thanks for this first hour. We'll be right back.